It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us today. I'm joined by film critics Charles Solomon of Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine, Tim Cogshell of Alt Film Guide and Cinegods.com, and Justin Chang, film critic for the Los Angeles Times. We begin with Ford v. Ferrari, a drama about the battle between two renowned car makers for supremacy at Le Mans in 1966. The film, directed by James Mangold, it stars Matt Damon and Christian Bale, also starring John Bernthal as visionary Ford executive Lee Iacocca.
You want us to think like them.
Enzo Ferrari will go down in history as the greatest car manufacturer of all time. Why? Is it because he built the most cars? No, it's because of what his cars mean. Victory. Ferrari wins at Le Mans. People, they want some of that victory. Now, what if the Ford badge meant victory?
Ford v. Ferrari, it's written by the Butterworth brothers, Jez and John Henry. Jason Keller also contributing the screenplay. Justin, what'd you think?
Well, I am not a car or car movie enthusiast at all, so I don't know if you should take it as a recommendation or not when I say that this one completely held my attention for across more than 2.5 hours, which is saying something. It's just, it's a beautifully controlled and assembled piece of filmmaking. This is so James Mangold's account of the 1960s feud between Ferrari, which was the gold standard at the time, untouchable when it came to making fast cars, and Ford, which was decidedly not. And it comes, it shows you how this came about after a failed merger attempt by Ford, which set the egos of Enzo Ferrari against Henry Ford II, who's played here in a delicious supporting turn by Tracy Letts, who's just so good in everything. And so it falls to the racing legends Carroll Shelby and Ken Miles, played by Matt Damon and Christian Bale, respectively, to produce a race car that could outpace Ferrari and win the 24 Hours of Le Mans. This movie has a very well-structured script, and the performances are terrific. Damon is the smart, sensible, calculating straight man to Bale's kind of wily and hot-headed, frequently irrational British genius who knows cars better than just about anyone else. So this movie is about the clash of these male temperaments and ego as much as it is about the clash of the vehicles in question. So, and a lot of the tension actually derives from whether Ford will accept someone who is as much of an outlier as Miles, the Bale character, into their ranks. And there's some priceless bits where Shelby is basically trying to outwit and pull rank over Iacocca, who's really well played by John Bernthal, who is kind of the villain of the bunch. The movie is very just shrewd and attuned to the ways of car manufacturing corporate culture. It takes you inside the mechanics of it, but also into the boardrooms where the decisions are made and Ford is screaming at his underlings and everything. It's very conventional, but very, very well done. The action scene climax at the end is very confidently staged and exciting and propulsive, which is saying something because it's 24 hours. And so there are acts, there are three acts even within that narrative itself. And the cars have to stop and be, you know, be attended to by their pit crews and everything. But, you know, James Mangold, who is a very, very good craftsman, and I think this is one of his better films.
I'm so looking forward to seeing Ford v. Ferrari. One thing, the stars, Matt Damon, they really made him look like Carroll Shelby. I was amazed at the resemblance. And the other thing, Christian Bale, we forget he's British, right? And he gets to use his real voice, his real accent in the film.
He really does, because you're used to him kind of, you know, his body is so elastic too, and his accents as well.
So but, so that's nice. Ford v. Ferrari, James Mangold directing. It's rated PG-13 in wide release. Also in wide release this week, Charlie's Angels, written and directed by Elizabeth Banks. Kristen Stewart, Naomi Scott, and Ella Balinska are the stars. Tim.
Ah, that Charlie's Angels movie that everybody's thinking about right now was the year 2000, 19 years ago. Hard to believe. I know I haven't aged at all in that time. And then there was a 2003 film, Full Throttle or something like that. This film here, though, is doing something that I really enjoy. It establishes something, this idea that I like a lot, that these angels... These angels are one or three, but a number of angels, an army of angels, with a lineage that goes back through a whole bunch of Bosleys, all the way back to 1976 and those first three angels at the Townsend Detective Agency, run by, you know, the voice of John Forsythe. the voice of John Forsythe is still coming out of that box.
Love it. In he this lives movie. On.
And I'm listening to that, and I'm thinking to myself, well, this guy like 150 years old or something like that. But you know what? These folks are clever. There's a reason why that's John Forsythe's
voice. Ah, it's part of the plot?
Yeah. And that was really... So here, we have these three additional new angels. Miss Stewart is just wonderful. I just love her. She's just fantastic. And you know what? I used to really beat her up a lot when she was a young actress coming out of Panic Room. Because she had this sort of bland, sort of like extremely contemporary thing. But over the years, she has just learned to throw it all at the movie screen. And she just bangs it out there. So she's fantastic in this movie, particularly Elizabeth Banks directing and also in the film. There's a plot. Has to do with...
Does it matter?
Yeah. Well, almost
isn't
none at all.
Do they blow stuff up?
Isn't that a first for a Charlie Sheen movie?
You know, almost none at all. I will tell you this, though. There's a twist, and then there's another twist. And there's another twist.
Oh, my goodness.
And I'm like, okay, you know, we're going to bang it. And none of this matters at all. These young women, all of these women, including Miss Banks, are kicking butt and looking fantastic in this movie. And that's really all that matters. Now, you could cut 20 minutes out of it, and you could probably lose two of those twists, and you'd still be okay in this movie. But they're having a doggone good time. One of the original angels pops up in this movie. I got to tell you, I just about jumped out of my seat.
One of the TV angels.
One of the original TV angels, and it was just the most wonderful thing. My heart was just palpitating. So I had a lot of fun over here with Charlie's Angels, and I think everybody else will too.
So fan service as well for the franchise Charlie's Angels. Kristen Stewart, Naomi Scott, and Ella Balinska. Elizabeth Banks, the writer-director. It's rated PG-13. The drama The Good Liar pairs Helen Mirren and Ian McKellen. Bill Condon directs, and Jeffrey Hatcher adapted Nicholas Searle's novel. Tim?
Yeah, Bill Condon. Gods and Monsters, 1998.
Love that film.
Wonderful movie. Yes. Ian with Bill. Worked together not too long ago on Mr. Holmes. Ian playing the aged Sherlock Holmes in that movie. So these guys sort of worked together quite well. This got off to a really good start, which I suppose is sort of like damning praise. But it does really get off to a very, it's sort of classically structured. It's like a good David Mamet play woven into a good Agatha Christie mystery. You're watching these cons, but there's something else going on. It even anticipates that we're going to do that thing that you do when you're watching the mystery where you try to get ahead of the story. You're like, oh, no, I know what's going on. I know. They're anticipating us doing that. And every time you think you got one, they plop it right down in front of you and say, no, that is not what's going on. You don't know. I love that they're anticipating that about the audience. They undermine it all at the end of the movie. When they explain it to us in a sort of Hercule Poirot style, everybody's in the room, and, you know, and I'm like, no, don't do that. But they do. Nevertheless, wonderful performances by Helen and Ian, and it's a fairly dark and brutal movie, too. Some horrible things happen in this movie, but there is yet another twist, which I won't ruin here.
To think of these two together, who can't seemingly give a bad performance? And you know, I was just thinking, I saw an ad on TV the other morning for this film, and I was just thinking, Helen Mirren works constantly. Mm. And there used to be women of her age. It would be so difficult to find meaty roles worthy of someone in her age range. But she's just and not just working, but in big roles in significant
films, kinds of genre films. And she doesn't play dotty old ladies all the time either. Every now and again, but generally speaking, she's playing people with verve, as she is in this.
And
film.
Ian McKellen doesn't seem to be winding down, so he keeps going. The Good Liar is the film Bill Condon directing, Jeffrey Hatcher the screenwriter. It's rated R in wide release. Next on Film Week, the drama Waves, starring Sterling K. Brown, Kelvin Harrison Jr., and Taylor Russell. It's written and directed by Trey Edward Schultz. Justin?
This movie kind of knocked me out, and I would recommend that people see it, and that you see it without reading too much beforehand or listening too much beforehand, although I'll tread very, very lightly over what happens in the movie, especially since a lot of this movie is not even about what happens on a plot level per se. This is a film by Trey Edward Schultz, who's the director of Krisha and It Comes at Night, scarily talented director in his 30s. And what he brings to these movies is just extraordinary camera work. The cinematography is by Drew Daniels. And in this movie, you see him trying to think through the camera and get into the life of this black family in South Florida, living in a comfortable Florida suburb, father, stepmother, son and daughter. And you're first with the son, who's played by Kelvin Harrison Jr., who I think is just one of the most interesting and young actors of his generation. He was in Luce. He was in Schultz's previous film, It Comes at Night. And here he plays a high school wrestling star who looks like just having the time of his life, you know, bright future ahead of him. The camera embodies this. It's just exuberant. It's moving. It's panning around, like swiveling 360 degrees around a car, you know, while he's driving along the oceanfront with his girlfriend. So this movie catches you up in this intoxicating mood of what it's like to be young and to have the whole world ahead of you. And it's a little bit showy, and some, you know, some might find the technique kind of bludgeoning, and I understand that, but I was just held with it. The title Waves, it kind of refers to, of course, it's near the beach, but it's also the way this movie builds scenes. There's a rhythm. There's like a stop and go, a tension and release. You know, sometimes you're in a scene and you're not entirely sure why you're there, but it's just super kinetic, super charged with energy. And then the plot kicks in, and it does have... There's a lot of melodrama here. He, you know, starts to experience some soreness in his shoulder. His girlfriend finds out she's pregnant and she wants to keep the baby. And that's where I'm going to stop it there. Something happens. The movie kind of ruptures. And then the second half kicks in, and you're following it from the perspective of his younger sister, played beautifully by a newcomer named Taylor Russell, who has been almost completely absent from the movie until this point. And the movie is partly about how men and young men tend to dominate the spotlight, especially in sports, in families sometimes. The teenage son, played by Kelvin Harrison Jr., has this very close but very difficult relationship with his father, who's played by Sterling K. Brown, who's just great as always. And so it's very meaningful and very moving when the second half kicks in, when you think almost like, where is this movie going? And you start to follow her. And she starts, you know, coming out of her shell because she's very quiet and reserved, where her older brother is so brash and reckless. This movie, it feels like almost a rendering of the spirit of this family. It's about tragedy. It's about how a family moves on in the in the wake of something that seems unthinkable, and how you cope with grief. These are not new dramatic conditions at all. But I found just the innovation, the formal innovation of the movie, and the superlative performances really, really affecting.
It sounds like there's a lot of space here for the characters to really. Exactly. Reveal themselves. And when you get a film that does that, so nothing as powerful as people. Forget the explosions, the special effects, but the ability of great actors to give you full lives.
Absolutely. And Schultz really does that. And two of his great influences are John Cassavetes, whose touch you really felt in Krisha a lot, just the kind of under-the-skin psychodrama, and Terrence Malick, whom he worked with on his documentary Voyage of Time. And so there's that kind of dreamy, poetic texture to the movie, too. So.
Waves is the film. Sterling K. Brown, Kelvin Harrison Jr., and Taylor Russell star Trey Edward Schultz, the writer-director. It's rated R at the Arclight Hollywood and the Landmark in West L.A. Let's just quickly get started, and then we'll continue after our break on the documentary Scandalous, the true story of the National Enquirer. Tim?
Ooh, a rip-roaring sort of biography of this. I've whiled away more minutes than I'd like to admit standing in grocery checkout lines, either actually holding that newspaper or sometimes just sort of staring at it.
And, how could you not read the front of it when you're waiting to pay?
And it's really interesting, this sort of history. And one of the things that this documentary is suggesting, though, is that National Enquirer magazine, that they were engaged in some real shoe-leather journalism. Very often, yes, aliens, yes, all of that, but very often shoe leather journalism that broke real stories. And then David Pecker takes it over.
We'll continue with it when we come back. Scandalous, the true story of the National Enquirer. It's directed by Mark Landsman. I also had a chance to see this documentary and was absolutely riveted by the film. But I want to hear what Charles Solomon has to say about it when we continue. Our critics are Charles, along with Tim Cogshell and Justin Chang. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. We have many more reviews to come. Stay tuned. We'll come your way right after this. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. I sure hope we're going to have a chance to see you at the Theater at Ace Hotel for our Film Week Academy Awards preview coming up on the Sunday morning, February 2nd, a week before the Oscars. We're doing a little earlier than usual because it's Super Bowl Sunday, so we'll be on 11 o'clock on stage, Theater at Ace Hotel. Tickets at kpcc.org/in-person. We're talking about the documentary Scandalous, the true story of the National Enquirer. Mark Landsman is the director. Charles, what'd you think?
Well, I was appalled by a lot of the material in this and felt like if these are journalists, I want to have a different title for my job. You know, at one point they're talking about going into stories with suitcases full of cash, literally, to give to people to get photographs. And then when the issue of the paparazzi hounding Princess Diana comes up, oh, well, the paparazzi were doing that. Why are you blaming us? They were clearly bought off more than once by celebrities. They were doing catch and kill before Trump. And they say, oh, well, maybe I'm a little bit ashamed of this, but not really all that much. This is such a sleazy thing they're uncovering. And the people who perpetrated some of these stunts seem to have no conscience, no remorse, no ethics, and no morals.
Well, that's what made them good at what they did.
Exactly.
If they weren't, if that wasn't how they were wired, they wouldn't have been able to do it.
Yeah, and of course, you know, today we look at TMZ and some of the other sort of things that came out of what they were doing at the National Enquirer. But again, I have to point out that one of the theses of this film is that a good deal of shoe leather journalism went on to tell factual stories about things that turned out to be true. Now, the writing in the Enquirer was terrible. These weren't good writers. They were simply writers willing to do things and then tell stories. So that's the difference, I think. And that's not something that they point out.
And they point out their political coverage, yeah. Gary. It was interesting they didn't get into the Kennedys because the National Enquirer was rather notorious for the way it covered the Kennedy family, sort of, you know, our version of royalty here in the U.S.
In that it didn't really cover the Kennedy family it, as deeply as it might have, given the way things are done today.
But they were also aware of some of Cosby's misdeeds long ago and allowed themselves to be bought off by access to him for favorable stories.
Yeah.
Because they were able to, didn't they do an in-depth Cosby exclusive interview they put on the front page? And that was sort of the deal, not to publish the allegations.
And then there's just a straight-out catch and kill that they started doing that works its way right up to the, you know, to the current president.
Starting with Schwarzenegger.
Yeah.
The film is Scandalous, the true story of the National Enquirer. It's unrated at Lemley's Royal Theater in West L.A. Atlantics, a film that takes us to Senegal. The film is written and directed by Matty Diop and Olivier Demangle. Tim?
I saw the feminist ghost story set in Dakar, Senegal. I'm going to let Justin talk about the director coming out of Cannes and all of that. This is a very, very deft movie made by this young sort of French black woman about these women. In Senegal, their boyfriends are working on this big tower project that's being built. They haven't been paid in months. They go and try to get their money. The man who owes them money won't see them, won't even talk to them. They decide that they have to do something. Eventually, they get on a boat and they head off to Spain, as happens often. These young men try to travel to Spain. Many, many hundreds have died at sea. We have a couple, Ada and her boyfriend, Suleiman. Ada, the young actress who plays Ada, is just absolutely striking in this movie. When the men disappear at sea, something odd starts to happen to the women. And we eventually start to understand that the ghosts of these men have come back and possess these women, their girlfriends. And they're using these women's physical forms to go after the man who took and stole their money. There's a sort of proto-feminist thing going on there. I take issue with it a little bit. There's something about the notion that these women are enfranchised by the souls of men that sets a little bit wrong with me. This may be a cultural thing on my part. I live here. I'm not in Dakar. I'm not in Senegal. One of the things that Ada is facing is she has an arranged marriage to somebody else, somebody not Suleiman. The movie does speak to the oppression of these young women, too. But then to give them agency by infesting them with the souls of men, tough one for me.
What'd you think, Justin?
That's a really interesting point. I really like this movie, but that is definitely food for thought. I mean, and it's interesting because the visual effects that they use, the kind of these milky-eyed, zombified looking women, it's so... One of the charms of this movie is just how low rent the visual effects are. It's a low budget film, and you wonder at first, like, is this just a put on? Is this actually happening? And the movie soon it becomes clear that it actually is. But there's a little room for ambiguity there at first. But I think the vision of the movie is very, you know, profoundly feminist, and it shows, you know, there's a scene in here in which Ada is taken for a premarital virginity test at a doctor, and which is something that has been in the news recently, and not just in Senegal. And so she shows you how the ruthless system of capitalist exploitation that sent these laborers to their death is tied to the same, you know, patriarchal religious, and it's not just Muslim, it's Christianity, it's lots of religions that try to keep, you know, that the policing of women's bodies. All of this, I think, this vision comes through very clearly, even though there are some points when I think the narrative falters and it's kind of a loose-limbed movie. But this is a really beautiful, hypnotically beautiful and assured filmmaking debut by Mati Diop, whom I've always loved just as an actor, first and foremost. You know, she was in Claire Denis' wonderful film, 35 Shots of Rum. She was the lead in that role. Yeah. And she's, you know...
Hermia and Helen.
That's right, Hermia Helena. That's right. Yes, yeah. She's a really striking actress, and I think she's absorbed some of Denis' sensibility. I see that in the way that the narrative kind of coalesces around these just strikingly beautiful images. She was the first black woman to, as a director, to compete at the Cannes Film Festival, and she won the Grand Prix. This movie is representing Senegal in the Oscar race for Best International Feature, and so I think it's really lovely.
And it'll be available on Netflix over Thanksgiving weekend, but see it now in the theater. Lemley's Monica Film Center is where it's screening. Netflix streaming doesn't come until the end of the month. Atlantic's is unrated, and again, Mati Diop is the director and co-screenwriter with Olivier Demangle. Crown Vic, an action film that follows a night in the life of an LAPD officer. Thomas Jane stars. Joel Souza, the writer-director. Tim?
Yeah, a night in the life of two LAPD officers, uniformed officers, sitting in that Crown Vic, the Crown Victoria police vehicle, long-standing police vehicle here in Los Angeles. This movie has shades of End of Watch. There's even something that connects this movie back to a film like Colors, when you had Robert Duvall and that young Sean Penn riding around in that car, 1987 or something like that. There's a quote that's spoken in this film, and the director talks about it all the time, and it's sort of like the thesis of the film. It's from Orwell's 1984. People sleep peaceably in their beds at night only because rough men stand ready to do violence on their behalf. From Orwell. This is the creed by which this cop, the older cop, Thomas Jane's character, lives by. He is a rough man ready to do violence on your sleeping behalf. The thing of it is, I've never asked a rough man to do any violence on my behalf. And I don't want them to. But that's a theme and a creed in this film. So we're with this cop and this new young cop. His father, the young cop's father, was on the force for years and years. And he wants to be a cop, but he's not really one of these kinds of people. But Thomas Jane is. And Thomas Jane tells him that outside of this car, there's them, and then there is us. All kinds of things happen over the course of this night, and we watch Thomas Jane being that rough man. Now, my problem with this movie, or perhaps this is just me, this movie wants us to empathize with Thomas Jane's character. It wants us to understand how this young, new officer is thinking about this, but it wants us to empathize with Thomas Jane's character. But the thing of it is, his character is just a crooked cop. Not crooked, and he doesn't take bribes or anything like that, but he is willing to do these rough things to citizens, inappropriate things to citizens, so that we can sleep peaceably. And we're supposed to be okay with that.
Is he wearing a body cam?
In this version of the Los Angeles Police Department, he's not. Also, you know, Larry, you're from here. I'm not from here, but I've been here for 30 years. This movie is not in Los Angeles. There's not. Look, man, I know L.A. There's not a street in Los Angeles in this movie anywhere. I did look it up, but I promise you, this movie is not in Los Angeles
at all. That's bad off the top. But this sounds a little bit like the Training Day scenario.
A little bit.
To some extent. You mentioned End of Watch, and that's one of my favorites. I really like that film
a lot. End of Watch.
Yeah,
I love
Michael Pena's performance. And Crown Vic is this film. Thomas Jane, Luke Kleintank, written and directed by Joel Souza. It's rated R and in select theaters. I Lost My Body is a French animated film. The director is Jeremy Clapin. Charles, what do you think of I Lost My Body?
Well, this is a film that's been getting a lot of attention on the festival circuit and is clearly a candidate for this sort of artsier Oscar nomination in the animated feature category later on. It's the story of a francophone Moroccan whose parents are killed. He's had a very happy, rather spoiled existence. He gets shipped to France and lives in one of the banlieues outside of Paris with his sleazy relatives and is trying to build his own life. He falls in love with a woman he meets trying to deliver a pizza to her, and complications arise. He ends up cutting off one of his hands in an industrial accident. And at the same time they're telling his story, the hand is trying to come back to his body. It's an interesting film. I would say it's a film I found interesting rather than that I loved. I've only seen it in French, so I don't know about the dub with Dev Patel. I think its problem is that he's not that terribly interesting a character. He's very isolated. He's very alienated. And he's not all that terribly interesting. You know, they're trying to make political points about the treatment of the Africans and other refugees in Paris, or just people from, you know, outside France who are now kind of warehoused in these ugly industrial complexes and the problems he has in trying to live in this city. But I just wish he were a little more interesting and sympathetic a character. And at the same time, you've got these creepy shots of this hand scuttling around, evading rats, getting caught by a dog, avoiding ants. It's an unusual film, but as I say, it is interesting.
We're talking about I Lost My Body, the French animated film. Justin, what was your take?
As with most movies, I think I like this more than Charles does. but I think you're right. I mean, he is not the most interesting character. The hand is a brilliant character, though. I mean, the hand is, like, for me, one of the great protagonists of 2019. I mean, and that's kind of the appeal of this movie. I think that, you know, it's a very inventive and clever story, you know, animated in a style that serves the material in a not groundbreaking but lovely to look at fashion. It's suspenseful. I found myself, you know, watching through my fingers, so to speak, as the hand is embarking
I've
on this.
Hand it to you, Justin.
All right, that's the line of the day.
Oh God, it's just embarking on this very harrowing journey, and as Charles was saying, you know, being attacked by rats and pigeons and falling into gutters and things, and you fear for this hand as if it were a full-bodied character. I think the back and forth structure, the time frames and stuff, it doesn't pay off quite as well as you would like it to. Although I like some of the scenes of the pizza delivery thing is actually quite funny and charming and poignant, but the hand, that's just what it's all about.
I think you're right that the weakness is that the ending isn't as satisfying as it should be for what it's taken us through so far.
But you like the animation, the style of it also, Justin?
I do, yeah. And there's some of it is in black and white, and some of it is quite evocative. It's nicely drawn.
I Lost My Body, French animated film, is unrated. It's on screen at Lemley's Music Hall Theater, and I believe it's going to be coming to Netflix, although I don't know that we have an actual Netflix date when I Lost My Body will be available. We have many more films to talk about. We'll do that coming right up on Film Week on KPCC. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle, joined this week by critics Tim Cogshell, Justin Chang, and Charles Solomon. 16 Bars, a documentary that follows four prisoners in a Richmond, Virginia jail. And the film is directed by Sam Bathrick. Tim.
And the film's set in a jail, of course. 16 bars, generally speaking, the length of a verse.
in a sort of hip-hop song. So this film, set in Richmond, Virginia, has Todd Speech Thomas, who is one of the members of the wonderful 90s hip-hop group Arrested Development, go into this prison to engage in this program where they take these prisoners, who most of whom are in there for some fairly serious things, but are slated to be released or at least to be reviewed for release. And the idea is to give them something that they can use to help divert them from coming back to prison again. Most of them are recidivists. In this room, there is so much talent that it's almost dizzying. Mostly black, a couple of Latino, and one white prisoner. This guy, number one, he's gorgeous. He looks like the guy that you leads Maroon 5, tall with the dark hair with the tattoos. He's just this gorgeous guy. He writes and sings and plays guitar, country music songs mostly, that are just, I'm listening to this, you know, I'm thinking he's going to be having these sort of hacky, you know. No, this guy has Johnny Cash talent.
So he looks like Adam Levine, performs like Johnny Cash.
Yeah, but he cannot stop messing up, mostly because of drugs. Almost everyone in this prison is there because of either drug use or something that they did while using drugs or selling drugs while using drugs. The drugs are the thing that is just destroying these communities, and they just can't stop. And we keep using one of the points that the film is making, that we're going to have to start treating drug use as a medical problem rather than a criminal problem. For one thing, we're locking away a lot of talent. Some of the songs that these mostly hip-hop guys write are just absolutely beautiful in the way that they are constructed. Arrested Development, of course, was what we used to call positive hip-hop, positive rap, as opposed to, you know, it's like, you know, some of the harder stuff,
gangsters,
sort of stuff like that. And this is the way that Todd is helping these guys shape their ideas. So they have these skills. They have a life that they want to talk about. And when he gives them, when he allows them to take all of that and put it into verse and then put it into song, and then he plays it back for them, it completely wipes them out, as it will you. This is like top 10 music that these people are creating, yet the burden of those drugs will not let them off the mat.
16 Bars, the documentary at Lemley's Monica Film Center. It's unrated. The thriller The Report stars Adam Driver, Annette Bening, and John Hamm. Scott Z. Burns, the writer-director, Justin.
Yeah, this is an understandably dry, semi-involving information dump of a movie. And it gives me no real pleasure to say that because I love information dump movies. Filing cabinet cinema where you feel like you're like stuck in a...
That's a new genre. That's
love funny. It. You know,
yeah,
you're stuck in like...
it when he's down in the dumps.
Exactly. I mean, you know, and as writers too, it's kind of, there's something very sympathetic about that. You're stuck in this grubby office with these characters as they're poring over documents and hurling exposition and jargon at each other. I mean, Zodiac is kind of the gold standard of this genre. That movie is mesmerizing in every detail in a way that The Report, unfortunately, just is not. It doesn't rise to that level. It's a shame because it is about an important subject, which is the U.S. Senate's years-spanning investigation into the CIA's endorsement of torture following 9/11. Adam Driver stars as Daniel J. Jones, who is tasked by Senator Dianne Feinstein with investigating the CIA, what the CIA is calling enhanced interrogation techniques. And that occasions a lot of grisly flashbacks to al-Qaeda detainees being subjected to these techniques. There are some good performances here. Annette Bening does a very good Feinstein frown. John Hamm is very slick as Obama's chief of staff, Dennis McDonough. And Driver, although not nearly as good here as he is in the very different Marriage Story, it's just a completely different kind of role, of course. But he really holds your attention as someone who is just superhuman in his devotion and his commitment to this completely thankless and yet extremely important project that spans years and years. The movie does convey some sense of what it is like to sacrifice years of your life in this dank little room, poring over these documents, typing up a report that not nearly enough Americans will pay attention to. So, you know, with a movie like this, I think a certain amount of tedium just comes with the territory. I mean, it wouldn't be true to its subject if it were not a little bit tedious. So I just don't think that there is ultimately enough of a dramatic payoff to compensate for that. And I think it's a very worthy piece of work. Scott Z. Burns is a smart filmmaker, but it's not great.
The Report, starring Adam Driver, Annette Bening, and John Hamm. It's rated R. It's at the Landmark in West L.A., and it'll be streaming on Amazon Prime Video beginning Thanksgiving weekend. Whitesnake, a Chinese animated fantasy film directed by Amp Wong and Zhi Zhao. Charles?
Well, China is very jealous of the soft power that animation and manga have brought Japan. K-pop has brought South Korea. And they're clearly trying to enter that sphere with some very elaborate animated films. There was Neza recently, and now The White Snake. And while this is a very beautiful movie, it is also confusing and overwrought. It's very loosely taken from an old Chinese folktale that goes back to at least the Ming Dynasty and is considered one of the four great Chinese folktales. It's been adapted to Peking opera. It's been adapted to television. It's been filmed about nine times before this and animated twice. You have this very powerful snake spirit who's been trying to achieve immortality through Taoist magic, named Blanca. And she meets up a sort of polymath, slightly klutzy, but really nice guy, Juan, who is working as a snake catcher to try and aid an evil general who's using snakes to try and reach immortality in his own ranks. And they are never have star-crossed lovers had to face so many obstacles. They have to fight the general and the general's army and his fey lieutenant in a veil. They have to fight the queen of the snake people and all her troops. Sometimes they have to fight Blanca's friend, who's been studying these techniques with her. It is confusing and overwrought, and there are endless battles and special effects, and you really wish they had pulled back and let you see how beautiful the designs are, particularly the serpents, are much better animated than the doll-like Blanca when she's human, and you wish it were just more coherent.
Justin.
I actually reviewed a White Snake movie 8 years ago, which was live action, but it was so just encrusted with CGI that it was almost as animated as this one. This one is better. It's not saying much. And it is insanely convoluted. I didn't mind that too much because it's interesting to see this studio quality, family friendly, you know, CG animation that's wedded to a wuxia martial arts story, it's this weird experiment almost, like where you're seeing that kind of mythology wedded to a very slick, corporatized kind of aesthetic where there is a, you know, a cute talking dog, and there's, you know, this jealous sister and with whom the main character has this antagonistic relationship, and there's this very garish comic interlude where you see what happens when a guy has to become a demon because he wants to be with her. So
Weird fox spirit who looked like the hostess from a 1920s bar in Shanghai.
It's a weird hodgepodge. I could have used less of the loud clanging action scenes, but I have to say there's a loveliness to the visuals that was transporting, and I think the movie is best in its kind of quieter, stiller moments where you're just on these mountaintops and looking, and it is transporting. But a mild recommendation on this one.
Chinese animated fantasy film White Snake is unrated. It's at the New Art Theater in West Los Angeles. Tim, just quickly, the documentary To Kid or Not To Kid about women not having children or that decision worth seeing?
Yeah. And the pressures that they and their husbands come under, particularly if they decided not to have children. Here, Maxine Trump, 40-some-odd years old, lived her entire life, knew that she didn't want children, now sort of questioning a little bit and talking to friends and others about this sort of decision. This is interesting to me because, you know, I decided not to have children in a very deliberate way.
Yeah, a lot of people are going to find this very relevant to their lives. To Kid or Not To Kid, Maxine Trump, the director. The film is unrated, the documentary. You can see it at Lemley's NoHo Theater in North Hollywood. For our Film Week critics, I'm Larry Mantle. Stay tuned. Joanna Cassidy is going to be with us from the stage at Theater at Ace Hotel as we talk Blade Runner from our recent Film Week screening. We'll be back in 1 minute.
It
It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. 2 weeks ago was our Film Week screening showing of Blade Runner, The Final Cut at the Theater at Ace Hotel in downtown L.A. We screened the movie to a sold-out crowd of 1,600. Afterwards, I was joined on stage by Film Week critic Wade Major and actress Joanna Cassidy. She plays the replicant Zora in the film. She has an iconic scene where she jumps through a plate glass window as Rick Deckard, played by Harrison Ford, shoots her dead. Cassidy ended up reshooting this scene for Ridley Scott's Final Cut, and I asked her why.
It always bothered me that people would say, oh, that didn't look like you going through the plate glass. I said, well, but it wasn't. And it bugged the heck out of me. So when they did, I guess it was the 20th reunion of the film, and Charlie made a little box and a cassette of all the actors and the producers and so on talking about the film. He and I talked about it, and I even said on my interview, I said, that really needs to be reshot. Let's do that. I don't know. Somehow we can get it done. But anyway, 25 years later, I still had the costume.
Yeah.
And I still fit in it. That's even better.
And so you have the clear raincoat too?
That I had everything.
Everything.
I had everything. And we reshot it in front of a green screen, obviously. So I did all the moves that my stunt girl did. And there you go. And you saw me tonight.
Wow.
So pretty fantastic. Pretty fantastic.
The snake that you worked with, was that a familiar snake?
The snake was Darling. No, Darling was my snake.
You're a snake.
That's how I got the part. I didn't sleep with the director. And my agent at the time said, there's this extraordinary movie, Joanna. I think you're the only person that can do it because you have the snake. So I met Ridley Scott. And, you know, as I look at it tonight, it's such a powerful film. It's just extraordinary. And Vangelis, I was there when he did a lot of the music. And I'm going to tell you something I don't think I've ever talked about. When I was 18 years old and I was driving across country with my then husband, they used to put out little skinny books that were about maybe 3/8 of an inch thick, funny shapes, 5x7 sci-fi books. And I was reading Philip K. Dick's Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep in a 1962 convertible DeSoto, black with red interior. And we're speeding across the country. And there we are, and there's this incredible sky. And I'm reading this book, and I'm going, wow, this man sees the future, and I want to be in it. And here we are.
Wow.
Here we are, 2019. And as a replicant, I have 1 year to live. But I think I'm going to outlive everybody. I just have a feeling.
Wade, this was a production that, despite the artistry, had some serious challenges financially along the way.
Yeah, the financing fell out. And they were worried. I mean, Michael Dealy, too, the producer. You know, he had won an Oscar for he'd done Man Who Fell to Earth, and then for The Deer Hunter, he won an Oscar. So he was, you know, he was a major producer, and the financing fell out just the same. And they had to go to Alan Ladd Jr., who had a deal with Warner Brothers, and he kind of threw them a life raft. And, you know, that doesn't happen anymore. Where, I mean, this was a $25 million movie at the time. That was not. I mean, it was significant, but it wasn't outrageous, you know. It was still a modest budget compared to some of the other big-budget things that were going on. So it's kind of extraordinary when you look at it, then you look at the talent involved and the credentials of the people that were coming into it, coming off of Alien, Ridley Scott, Vangelis coming off of an Oscar win for Chariots of Fire, you know. A movie like that shouldn't have financial problems. So it's kind of an extraordinary artifact of a different time.
Let's talk about the technology of it, speaking of how extraordinary it was. And Joanna, maybe you can speak to this point. How much of what we see in the scenes like the Bradbury Building, or the is in physical space, how much of it is done through computer-generated images?
Well, just watching the end of the film again, there was some great hand acting with Harrison, some of the best I've ever seen. And I remember I was there because I had just finished my scenes. I was brought in at the very end of the film to shoot Zora's scenes. I had been rehearsing all along to do the snake dance, which never got shot.
There's no lost snake dance to find. Never shot.
Never shot, but I did the dance 8 years ago. And it's on YouTube.
Really?
So you can see it. I'm a little older, but it's okay.
Finally, as we conclude our conversation, I just want to ask each of you about what you think the significance of the story is. What you think is the ultimate wisdom, if you will, or vision that the film leaves. Wade?
I think it's an amazing confluence of visions, because it's not just Philip K. Dick, it's not just Ridley Scott, it's Hampton Fancher, and it's David Peoples, and it's Sid Mead, and it's all of these visions that come together. And everyone is sort of orbiting the same question, which is, what does it really mean to be human? And it's a question that finds its way in all kinds of science fiction films, all the way from Fritz Lang's Metropolis through 2001, and it adds a great deal to that conversation, because it takes the idea of a robot or an android or a creation, and it moves it to an extra step and says, these are humans, and these people allegedly aren't. What's the difference? And it asks you as the viewer to sort of play God and define exactly what makes a human. And it doesn't really give you a perfect answer, and it shouldn't. Movies shouldn't give you answers. They should force you to ask questions. And I think that's why when I was, 17, watching this movie, why it just stirred me so. Because it's a question that sticks with you. When you get to be 30 and 40 and you go on through life, you keep asking yourself that question. And this movie keeps lingering.
Joanna?
You know how we have certain epiphanies in our lives, and there's that old Andy Warhol saying, we all have 15 minutes of fame. Something happened during that movie that doesn't happen often. It's where, almost in a way, the worlds collided. You had all these phenomenal creative people all at the same place at the same time. It didn't matter what the stress was. It didn't matter what the problems were, money, no money, whatever. Arguments, disagreements, the vibration was there. And I swear, it came from the earth. Here's a little girl reading the book at 18 and then playing the part years later, Ridley buying this book and wanting to do this project, Sid Mead making those models, all the other actors. I swear, it was like there was a little world and all these threads going out to all these different people and just drawing them in. And this is what happens in life when you have those amazing times in life where it just comes together.
From our post-screening conversation, our last film week movie showing at the Theater at Ace Hotel with Blade Runner star Joanna Cassidy, Film Week critic Wade Major in conversation. Thanks so much for joining us for another Film Week on KPCC. Have a great weekend.